thing on the internet and at 90.1 FM from high atop Burnaby Mountain. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, genocide in Gaza. Is Israel guilty of this crime of crimes? One thing is clear, genocidal incitement permeates Israeli society.
Incitement against Gazans, vicious incitement to commit the most atrocious crimes. Speech does affect the way people behave. Do these genocidal ethnic cleansing talk in Israel affect how a soldier in Gaza now behaves? I'm sure it does.
How to stop Israel's assault? Some call for international intervention.
You might argue that by virtue of what is taking place in the Gaza Strip, violations of Hughes Kogan's norms, derogation from which is not permitted, including the prohibition on genocide, forcible transfer of a protected population, that is ethnic cleansing and so on, that states are compelled to act.
And the Anthropocene, a wake-up call from a Canadian earth scientist.
The message for society is essentially, wake up, we are in trouble. And whatever we do, even with zero future emissions, we're going to be living with the consequences of the great acceleration for hundreds and maybe thousands of years to come. Whatever we do.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before diving in, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. This coming Thursday and Friday, the international community's highest judicial body, the International Court of Justice, will be hearing arguments for and against the proposition that Israel is committing genocide in its war on Gaza. That proposition has been put forward by the Republic of South Africa. In an 84-page submission to the ICJ, lawyers for South Africa argue that Israel's assault on Gaza matches the definition of genocide set forth in the 1949 Genocide Convention. The ICJ could take years to adjudicate South Africa's claim. In the meantime, South Africa has asked the court to issue an injunction calling on Israel to halt its assault on Gaza. The court's decision turns largely on one question. Are Israeli political and military leaders deliberately inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction of the Gazan people, in whole or in part, as genocide is defined? It's a tough question. Nothing harder than proving genocidal intent among those directly involved in the killing. One thing is clear. Genocidal rhetoric permeates Israeli society. In a December 28th letter to Israel's attorney general and state prosecutors, 15 prominent Israeli figures document extensive and blatant incitements to genocide, expulsion, and ethnic cleansing by Israeli politicians, media commentators, activists, and social influencers, and the absolute silence of the judicial system. Israeli attorney Michael Sfard represented the authors of the letter. I reached Michael Sfard in Tel Aviv. Tell me about this letter that you sent to the Israeli foreign ministry and to various senior prosecutors in the state of Israel. Tell me about how this letter came about.
It's a letter that was sent to the attorney general and to the prosecutor general. It was in the making for a while because there was a group of Israeli former ambassadors that thought the genocidal rhetoric that has become something that is unbearable and must be tackled, must be challenged. And then one of the things when we discussed this that I raised is that it's not only a public matter that needs to be scrutinized by the Israeli leadership and delegitimized by it, but also it's a legal issue, and that the Israeli law enforcement authorities have a duty to stop it. And so that's how the idea of writing a letter to the top legal law enforcement individuals came about. The moment we decided to do it, the numbers of signatories inflated very quickly. And in fact, there are many others that did not get into the letter because it was urgent for us to issue it.
And you write, the combination of the complete absence of enforcement response to the statements which are the subject of this letter, coupled with the public prominence of the inciters and the broad stage they have brought about a situation in which the discourse of annihilation, expulsion, and revenge has been normalized, legitimized, and expanded. Today, calls of these types are an everyday matter in Israel.
I must say, I was born in Israel. I was raised in Israel. I lived all my life in Israel. I would have never imagined in my wildest dreams that I will write a letter like this.
Is this a new phenomenon, Michael? All these expressions of apparently genocidal intent, or really has this been going on for years, perhaps in a more subtle way, if one can convey genocidal ideas in a subtle way? Has this always been an undercurrent in Israeli political discourse and social national discourse, or is this something new?
There were always elements that were in the very, very far fringes that were, I would say, weightless in the past, that you could find speech that remotely resembles to what we see now. But the fact that it now occupies the mainstream, basically, the right-wing mainstream, is just incredible. And it happened very, very quickly. I mean, we could put the finger on several steps that brought about this kind of speech from the far fringes of what was seen by most Israelis as lunatics to the center stage. And I think a very important step towards it was the legitimization that the Kahanist groups have received from Netanyahu for political reasons. He needed them first to back his coalition, then to allow him to create a cabinet. And he provided them with legitimization and with power, with administrative power, with official power. And so this kind of talk that was before really far, far away from the mainstream and not get any exposure in the mainstream media is now a very, as I wrote in the letter, a daily occurrence in Israel.
And this contrasts with the vigorousness with which Israeli police authorities pursue Palestinian Israelis, Israeli Palestinians who convey ideas on Facebook.
This gap between the complete inaction when it comes to incitement against Gazans, vicious incitement to commit the most atrocious crimes, and by people with very loud speakers, with a lot of exposure, influencers, the complete impunity that they receive, the gap between that and the very hectic, intensive action that is taken against every anonymous Palestinian with Israeli citizenship who said anything on Facebook that is remotely can be understood by someone as backing up the Hamas or celebrating the Hamas successes, quote unquote, is inexplicable. It shows, and I think we wrote that as well in our letter, it suggests that the law enforcement agencies are committed only to tackle incitement that could, in their eyes, hurt Jewish Israelis, but would not do anything against incitement that is much more effective, that is aimed against Gazan civilians.
What's the connection between this kind of discourse, Michael Sfard, and Israel's actions, the Israeli military's actions in Gaza? Is there a connection between the discourse and the actual pursuit of military aims in Gaza on the part of the Israeli, the IDF? And of course, this comes in the context of this request for provisional measures from the Republic of South Africa at the International Court of Justice, which is coming before the ICJ on the 11th and 12th of January, alleging that Israel is committing genocide or is engaged in genocidal acts in Gaza, and asking the ICJ. So I gather your letter was sent to authorities before the South African application became public, but it's interesting that the two are coming side by side.
Yeah, I was not aware. I did not know that South Africa is planning to file this proceeding to the ICJ. As your question, it is very difficult to make a direct line between speech and actions, but we know that speech mobilizes action. This is the power of speech. And I'll give you an example I gave in the letter. When it comes to, for example, to the issue of treatment of Palestinian militants, terrorists who are attacking Israeli civilians in Israeli streets and are neutralized. And then the question of them being wounded, what to do with them. There was a campaign by the Israeli radical right, quote unquote, not to have any terrorist leave the site of a terrorist attack alive. Now, that is, of course, immoral and illegal, because if someone is already neutralized, is injured, is not, does not pose any danger, then you should not, of course, attack him. And for years, we had cases where human rights organizations have been warning that attackers have been killed in circumstances that are completely illegal, when they were no longer posing any danger. And a few weeks ago, this tragedy happened in Jerusalem, when a Jewish Israeli saw that there is an attack on people who are standing in a bus station by two Palestinians with armed Palestinians. And he went out and shot them. Now, soldiers that came to the scene thought that he was also one of the gunmen. He dropped his gun, he raised his hands, he took off his jacket, and he shouted to them not to shoot him. And nevertheless, they shot him, and he was killed. So speech does affect the way people behave, especially speech that is seen as legitimate and is not confronted by the leadership, both the political leadership and the legal leadership. And so when I ask myself, do these genocidal ethnic cleansing talk in Israel affect how a soldier in Gaza now behaves? I'm sure it does to a certain extent. That doesn't mean that there is indeed a genocidal plot, and the ICJ will have to deal with that question. And as you, I'm sure you know, the allegation of genocide is an allegation of the gravest crime we have, but also it's the most difficult one to prove. And the fact that there were people, even very prominent people, even members of the Israeli parliament and even a cabinet minister, that have made statements, genocidal statements, is not yet a proof of genocidal intent of the war, of the army. That's a leap that South Africa will have to prove, and for one, I think it will be difficult to do that.
But it certainly lends credence to the argument that there is, dolus especialis, there is intent to commit genocide. Yeah, I mean, your letter, right? I mean, you know, this is all laid out quite extensively in South Africa's letter itself. They lay out all these various statements that have been made. But now, you know, several dozen Israeli academics and public figures on this letter are now essentially saying the same thing and adding even more examples of this.
You have to bear in mind that in order to prove the commission of the crime, you have to prove that the same individuals who are trusted with the power to issue commands and to the army are the ones that bear this intent, this special intent. So, you know, it's like, you know, robbery is theft together with intimidation. It's not enough to show that one person intimidated and the other stole in order to prove there is a robbery. You need to prove that the same person did both things. So it's more complicated than just to show that within the Israeli society, there is genocidal intent. You have to show that this is the intent of the decision makers vis-a-vis the Gaza assault.
What's been the reaction to your letter, Michael? And what reaction are you anticipating or asking for?
So first of all, our letter demands that the Attorney General and the Prosecutor General will crystallize a policy towards these kind of statements, incitements. And I do expect a response, and I do expect a rapid response, because this is something that is urgent. I did not know, as I said before, that South Africa will file its proceedings before the ICJ, but definitely that adds up to the relevance of this letter when it comes to our letter. Is a moral shout, of course. But now there is another reason for the government to address the issue that we raised, and that is the legal exposure that these statements, these incitements bring about. So I do expect a response to the merits of our letter, and quite soon. As for the reaction, I think we've received enormous amount of support from many, many Israelis. And it goes to show how times of war silence people, because so many people felt the same, but didn't say anything, didn't do anything. And it's important that there are those courageous people who do speak out, and then they mobilize others who would not be the first one to say stuff, but now they're coming out and in support. So I'm expecting, I'll be very cautious, but I'm expecting more letters of this kind, with the same kind of messaging to be circulated in coming days and weeks.
It's hazardous, I think, for an Israeli person, a public figure, certainly somebody who doesn't have a lot of public stature, to suggest that Israel's intent in Gaza is genocidal, or that, more generally speaking, Israel, the state, seeks to wipe out the Palestinian people. Is that a hazardous thing to say?
Well, I just want to be very accurate. Our letter does not suggest that. Our letter says that there are people, certain individuals, that have expressed genocidal incitement and intent. We did not conclude that Israel as a state has that intent. And I think, look, the issue of freedom of expression, political expression in Israel since October 7th is a huge one. I wrote a big op-ed in the New York Times a couple of weeks after October 7th, describing what a pit we fell into when it comes to free speech, to criticize our government, to advocate end of the war, to criticize the way we fight and the way we bomb Gaza, and to argue that grave violations of international laws of war are being committed. The Israeli governmental apparatus has suppressed free speech in a degree that people, my friends and I, warned throughout the years that this is where we're heading. But I've never really believed that I'll see the day when the Israeli police chief says there will be no demonstrations in support of the Gazans. I will not allow any of them. I did not think that I would live to see the day when the High Court of Justice backs up the police when it comes to suppression of demonstrations. So in October 6th, our situation was not very good when it comes to free speech. But after October 7th, it deteriorated to a degree of really regimes that we definitely do not want to be similar to.
Michael Sfard, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, David, for having me.
Michael Sfard is an Israeli attorney specializing in human rights and international humanitarian law. Read more about genocide ideology in Israel at greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. To start and supposedly hard to stop. In truth, halting bloody conflicts is easy if the world's most powerful nations resolve to do it. Take Israel's war on Gaza, now into its fourth month. If the U.S. demanded that the violence stop immediately, it would. Israel has now killed over 22,000 Gazans, including almost 8,000 children. Another 8,000 are missing and presumed dead under the rubble. 55,000 have been injured. Over 355,000 homes have been destroyed. two-thirds of Gaza's housing stock. So have bakeries, schools, universities, businesses, mosques, churches, cemeteries, cultural sites, municipal buildings, critical infrastructure, and most of Gaza's hospitals. How to halt Israeli bloodshed? A sharply worded order by the world's highest court will not do it. An international enforcement operation under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, issued by the UN Security Council, almost certainly would. Pure fantasy. The Council can't even call for a ceasefire. The U.S. won't allow it. There is an alternative. The UN General Assembly's Uniting for Peace resolution, approved by two-thirds vote of the Assembly. To learn more about Chapter 7 and the Uniting for Peace resolution, the GPM spoke with Artie Imsis. Imsis is Assistant Professor of Law at Queen's University in Ontario. Imsis' latest book, The United Nations and the Question of Palestine, has just been published by Cambridge University Press. Observing the situation that's going on in Israel-Palestine, Israel's assault on Gaza now into its, 85th or 90th day, with all the bloodshed, like over 20,000 dead Palestinians, half of them women and children, 50 or 60,000 injured, and starvation looming, and it's just a humanitarian disaster of the sort that the international community has not seen in a long time. It occurs to me that there's such a simple solution, that the UN Security Council just needs to invoke Chapter 7, which involves various tiers of action, but three tiers culminating in international enforcement action. And I have in my mind, a whole fleet of American and British and French and Spanish and Italian. Let's leave the Turks out of it. The whole naval force off the coast of Gaza, basically putting an end to the conflict, restoring order and peace and security. I'd like you to talk about Chapter 7, Artie Imsis, as a vehicle for doing this. But of course, the bottom line is that this is just fantasy, because the UN Security Council can't adopt a resolution calling for a ceasefire, because the U.S. won't allow it. So Chapter 7 is just absurd to think of such a thing happening. But can you comment on that? It is the ultimate instrument, isn't it?
Absolutely. Happy to do that. I suppose the best place to start for your listeners is with the general introduction to what powers exist in various bodies at the United Nations, and then engage with a discussion of Chapter 7 and enforcement action. The United Nations was formed in 1945, following World War II, and the goal of the organization was to impose a collective security arrangement such that the great powers would be less likely to engage in armed conflict against one another of the sort that had taken place in the 50 years prior to the establishment of the organization, World War I and World War II, respectively. The organization, of course, also bolsters the rules-based international legal order, human rights law, and all of that. But as part of that order, the UN has six principal organs, two of which are political and a few others. So the political organs are the Security Council, made up initially of 11 members, now 15. And the Security Council has the principal primary responsibility, for what we call international peace and security. And then you have the General Assembly, which is the plenary body of the United Nations, made up of all member states of the United Nations today, numbering some 193 member states, with two non-member observer states being the State of Palestine and the Holy See. And then you have the Economic and Social Council, which is responsible for, among other things, economic and social issues, including human rights. It is about 47, maybe 49 member states that are drawn from the General Assembly. It might even be 50 or 51 these days. And then you have the Trusteeship Council, which is meant to deal with, largely a dead letter, but meant to deal with the non-self-governing territories following the League of Nations mandate system and the folding up of the League of Nations. And then finally, the principal judicial organ of the United Nations being the International Court of Justice, the World Court, as it were. Now, zeroing in on the Security Council, as being mandated to maintain international peace and security, the Council passes resolutions that under Article 25, when couched in the terms of a decision, Article 25 of the UN Charter, are binding on all member states. So that creates law, if you like. And there are five members of the Security Council, five of the 15, that are permanent, and they possess veto power, as you've mentioned. And so no resolution of the Council can pass unless you have unanimity or at least an agreement among members of the P5, that is China, Russia, United Kingdom, France, and the United States, either not to veto or to abstain on the resolution or indeed vote for. There has to be some unanimity. And so the idea that your question gives rise to is simple. When there is threat to international peace and security as determined by the Security Council, which the Council is authorized to make that determination under Article 39 of the UN General Assembly, then the Council has open to it a number of measures that it can take under Articles 41 and 42 in particular of the UN Charter to enforce international law to ensure international peace and security.
According to Article 40, it can just Security Council can just call upon the parties concerned to comply. And under 41, it may decide, okay, the parties aren't complying, we're going to use other measures like economic measures or diplomatic measures. And the third is international enforcement.
That's right. So you have provisional measures available to the Security Council under Article 40. Then you have non-forcible measures available to the Security Council under Article 41. And then you have use of force under Article 42 by members of the Council, so long as the Council first determines under Article 39 that there is a threat to international peace and security in the matter that is before it. So if you like, theoretically speaking, where there is a threat to international peace and security of the sort that exists today in the Gaza Strip, you know, we know that there is a threat to international peace and security there, certainly by the fact that the Secretary General some weeks ago declared it to be so, then it is open to the Security Council to act so long as there is no veto by any of its members, its permanent members. And the actions, as you say, theoretically are rather widespread. You'd mentioned a naval blockade. That certainly is within the realm of the possible. State practice shows that when the Council has the political will to pass resolutions and assert itself through its decisions, it can do any number of things, either forcible or non-forcible. So let's begin with non-forcible measures, right? Or even provisional measures. It can call on the parties to cease fire. It can remind the occupying power of its obligations under, say, the Genocide Convention, that is to not commit genocide, or under the Fourth Geneva Convention, that is to protect the civilian population subject to its effective control, to respect international humanitarian law, and so on. And these things are done in any number of resolutions, including the resolutions that have been passed already on this matter. The parties to the conflict have been reminded of their obligation to ensure respect for international humanitarian law, for instance. But then moving from provisional measures to non-forcible measures, economic sanctions is one, diplomatic sanctions is another, trade embargoes, arms embargoes. And once decisions of the Council are made, those decisions would be binding on all member states of the United Nations, which is basically the whole of the international community. So you can imagine that those non-forcible measures would be strong and capable of putting enough political, economic, and other types of pressure on the occupying power to cease and desist from what it is doing now in the Gaza Strip.
But I mean, again, just pointing out to the listeners what should be obvious to anybody who knows anything about anything, that this is just pure fantasy.
Yes.
That our Chapter 7 would never, ever be invoked by the UN Security Council. I mean, it's kind of like, I don't know what parallels I could come up with to capture a situation that's just some other universe, but not our own. But it seems to me striking that if an international intervention force were to gather off the coast of Gaza and a no-fly zone were to be declared, and the Israelis were to be told, you're getting out now, like within 24 hours, and the international community's taking over control of Gaza. I mean, of course, Israel would go apoplectic, but if the U.S. were on side with this and everybody else, the British and the French and, you know, the Germans and the rest of them,